And our special guest tonight, Peter Lavenda, lots more to talk with him about the occult, including some UFOs. And his book is subtitled The Nine. What's that all about? I'm sure we're not talking about a par nine golf course now with nine holes. Not at all. I'll be back in a moment. Peter, have you ever heard about the Bohemian Grove out here in California?
Oh, sure. Yes, I've seen some video of that as well.
We've got a regular guest, Alex Jones, who infiltrated the place, another guy also by the name of John Runson. Do you think strange things go on there?
Well, they seem to. From the brief bits of video that I've seen of the Bohemian Grove activities, it does seem very strange to me.
Again, though, what it all is, you know, here are grown adults, grown men, in this club-type atmosphere, doing these very strange things, these weird rituals, and whether anything happens there or not, just the fact that these prominent people would spend time to do this, that's weird all by itself.
Absolutely. It's very, very strange. Well, as a matter of fact, speaking of that, I think you mentioned the Nine.
Yes.
And that is an example of just exactly this. And speaking about occult influences in our government and in our country today, the Nine is probably the juiciest example, the most documented example of a group of people who represented some of the wealthiest families and the oldest families in our country getting around a seance table and contacting otherworldly forces. The Nine goes back to a man called Andrea Puharic, who was a famous psychic researcher who he died a few years ago, but he was very prominent.
In this country?
In this country,
okay.
Yes. He was of Yugoslavian origin, but he was born in the United States and raised here. And Puharic used to work for Fort Detrick out there in the Chemical Biological Warfare Group.
Yep.
Right after the Korean War, during the Korean War. But he was very involved in paranormal things and in psychic research and all of that. He got together on New Year's Eve, 1952, that's December 31st, 1952, he got together some of the strangest group of people you could imagine. Arthur Young, his wife Ruth Forbes, Alice Astor, and Marcella DuPont. I mean, DuPont, Forbes, and Astor right away. And Arthur Young, who was the inventor of the Bell helicopter. And a number of other people, nine people altogether.
Prominent, wealthy people.
Prominent, wealthy, well-connected, blue blood, old money. And they got around a seance table in the woods in Maine in 1952 on New Year's Eve. They had no place else to go, I guess. And they're having a seance in which they're being contacted by a group that calls itself the Nine. And they refer to themselves as nine principles and nine forces. And they're telling this group of people, these individuals around the seance table, that these nine people are being selected as the new Brahmins of the new age. Now, this wouldn't become particularly interesting, except that Andrea Puharic goes on to be the guy who basically discovers Uri Geller and
brings him
to the United States.
I did not know.
He also brought Peter Hurkos, the famous clairvoyant, to the United States.
You know, I know Uri Geller. He's been on the program a couple times. I met him in St. Louis several years ago. This is fascinating. Go ahead.
Well, if you talk to Uri the next time, just mention the phrase the Nine and see what he does, because he's very paranoid about that these days and about his relationship to Puharic.
Okay.
Uri Geller believes that Andrea Puharic was his CIA control. Puharic did work for the intelligence apparatus back in the 1950s and 60s, and maybe until his death, we don't really know for sure. Arthur Young, of course, as the inventor of the Bell helicopter, he quit Bell helicopter right after World War II and devoted his life to the study of the paranormal. So there's a lot of very high-powered people were at this strange seance in the Maine woods.
Now, what got them together, do you know, for this initial seance in the first place? I mean, were they there to try to contact this group?
Well, it wasn't you know, it wasn't a cocktail party, you know, in a brownstone. I mean, they really did go for this particular purpose. I mean, it was really far to go, and in 1952, very difficult to get there.
Somebody had to put this all together, though.
Puharich put it together.
He's the one. He was the ringleader.
Puharich was the ringleader, definitely.
Okay.
And he had a man called Dr. Vinod, and Dr. Vinod was the medium that was being used to contact these forces.
Okay.
So this, it did something to Puharich and to everybody else around that seance table. It kind of ignited something in them, and they all went out and started becoming extremely involved in the paranormal. But what is interesting to me, and maybe we want to save some of this information for another show, is the fact that Arthur Young and his wife Ruth Forbes Young were intimately involved with one of the main characters in the Kennedy assassination.
And who was that character?
That was Ruth Payne. Ruth Payne was the person with whom Marina Oswald and Lee Harvey Oswald stayed in Dallas.
Okay,
she was the person that Marina Oswald was staying with her at the time of the assassination. Ruth Payne was very helpful in helping the FBI find evidence against Oswald and everything else. Ruth Payne is the daughter-in-law of Arthur Young.
Okay.
Arthur Young's son-in-law, stepson, excuse me, is Michael Payne. Michael Payne was working for Bell Helicopter at the time in Dallas. And his wife, Ruth Payne, was visiting Arthur Young about a month before the assassination.
Do we think it was a money thing for this seance? Do you think these prominent people all had to cough up some cash for Puharich?
Well, they were all helping to finance him, for sure. Yeah. There was a lot of money coming in from all of these sources to Puharich.
So what are the chances that the ringleader of the seance, the medium that they used, you know, was a fraud, and, you know, he made some cash on the deal, too? I mean, was this a possibility that they merely tricked these bored, wealthy people?
Well, I would say it's a possibility, except for one particular instance that Puharich writes about at length, because it made a very big impression on him. Vinod, as the medium, was able to solve a very complex mathematical equation that had defeated Puharich and his research assistants for some time. So during the seance, the complex equation was solved right before them.
What year was this?
1952.
Well, Einstein was still alive, wasn't he?
Yeah.
So they couldn't have tapped into him.
No. No, the people who claimed to be the nine principles and forces made allusions to the fact that they might have been Egyptian deities. There were further allusions that they were occupying a UFO, a spacecraft over the planet Earth, and were communicating to the nine from someplace hovering above the Earth. This idea of the nine kept getting repeated and repeated. Puharich, to the end of his days, was a devoted proponent of this group called the nine. And if you read a book by Picknett and Prince called The Stargate Conspiracy, they talk about the nine as well. They talk about the seance. They talk about all of this and the effect it had on Egyptology for years after that.
Okay,
Some of the members became involved in archaeological research and in Egyptology.
But the nine now, they were the supernatural group. They weren't the people who were sitting there at the seance.
They were both, because there were nine people at the seance, and there were nine entities that were being contacted.
Okay.
It was kind of a one-to-one deal.
All right.
Well, I use the term the nine interchangeably to mean either the group at the seance or actually the people being contacted or the entities being contacted.
I wonder what other things were told to the group from the nine that they may have acted on or used or tried to, you know, get into politics and run part of this planet that way.
Well, that's the $64,000 question, because The documents of the seance had never been published. Only parts of it have been published by Puharich, but there was a lot that was not.
Was any of it dangerous? Was any of that, you know, threatening to the individuals who were part of the seance?
It didn't seem to be. I mean, they remained closely in contact with Puharich throughout the period thereafter. So there doesn't seem to have been any threat involved. Uri Geller, when he became involved with the Nine, and he was contacted by the Nine as well, I think at one point he felt threatened by it.
In what way?
Well, he doesn't really go into too much detail about it. he seems to think that Buharich was a CIA control or an intelligence agent of some kind.
So there are some things that Uri does not like to talk about.
Yes.
One includes when he was a little boy, how he got zapped by a UFO, which he believes was one of the things that gave him the abilities that he has.
I see.
A long, long time ago. But
well, he doesn't like to talk about the nine either, from what I understand.
Okay. Well, I wonder how he would answer that question. I'll ask him, though. It's almost time for him to come back on.
I'd be fascinated to find out.
I got to tell you, though, Peter, I mean, he did an exercise on this program, and he basically had people bring their stopped and dead watches and clocks and things like that close to the radio.
Uh-huh.
And in some cases, people's watches were working, and they didn't have batteries anymore. You know, the batteries were taken out, or they had died 5 years ago, and they were working. I mean, I was getting hundreds of what we call fast blast messages and emails from people who were saying, oh, my God, like my clock is working, hasn't worked in 5 years. So he's got some kind of power.
Well, I don't doubt it. I don't doubt it. I think Buharich himself was thrilled with Geller and took him to the Stanford Research Institute in California to be tested and so on and so forth. But I think there was a falling out. And I think that part of the reason for the falling out was the nine.
You mean maybe Uri didn't want anything to do with it anymore?
Possibly, yes.
Now, this Buharich, once he finally died, did he take with him a lot of secrets, or did things continue to move on?
Well, things seem to have moved on. I think that he did take a lot of secrets with him. I think a lot of his documents went missing. But I think that in some cases, some of what he was involved with did go on, because there were people who claimed similar contact with the nine, including one famous theoretical physicist, a man called Jack Sarfati, who had a lot of very similar experiences to what Buharich had with the nine, to what Uri Geller had, being contacted by mechanical voices on the telephone and as a young man, claiming to be a spaceship hovering over the Earth, et cetera, et cetera.
That's an amazing story all by itself. Did they elaborate on that specific event?
Well, Sarfati still does. Sarfati is a correspondent on the Internet. You can find him. He has his own website and a kind of biography of himself, an autobiography. And he does. He's very open about this event in his life when he was a young boy, I think being groomed for one of the secret schools that were in operation in the United States in the 1950s and early 1960s. They were training young people of high IQ in things that we don't know, quite frankly. And Sarfati was I think being tapped as one of those children.
Do the supernatural nine still appear from time to time, or are they gone now? The entities.
Well, if you were to ask some of the people like Sarfati, they would probably say that they're still active. That the nine is still around. They're just not quite as prominent as they were when Buharich was their spokesman, as it were.
What kind of entities were they, Peter? Were they good entities, or there some evil here?
That's the question. You know, I think the point of view of the Stargate conspiracy of Pikmin and Prince is that they were evil, or at least we couldn't really be sure one way or the other. Buharich seemed to think that they were good entities. So there's a lot of controversy about it. We don't know what the agenda is of the nine. We'd have no idea what they really want or what they were trying to accomplish.
Do we know, though, specifically if people are continuing to try to contact them?
I've heard that they have been. I've heard that some people connected with the Esalen Institute, for instance, were involved in trying to maintain contact with the nine, some people affiliated with that organization. So it's still the subject of a lot of talk and a lot of gossip in this type of community.
Would you like to sit in on one of those seances if they did one?
Well, I think I would like to, just for information purposes and to see, you know, to get an idea, a feel for what type of entities we're talking about.
Well, you know what? On two fronts. One, if it's real, if it happens, that's I think, mind-boggling all by itself. But the other part, though, is, are these people who have so much wealth, so much power, they dabble in these things? Why? What is it about their psyche that makes them do that?
Well, I think you've almost answered it right there. They have so much wealth and they have so much power, and they're still not satisfied. They're lacking something. They're lacking a contact with something beyond themselves, something more eternal, or something more transcendental that they can't find with their status in life or their situation in life.
So why reach out, though, to the occult? Why not reach out to some religion or some direction that way?
I think because they're probably too cynical to do that. You know, people like this are already very well connected with organized religion, and they have a close relationship with the hierarchy, with bishops, with cardinals, with people who run these organizations. And I think they become cynical because of their contact with people like that. They don't sense a deep spirituality, or they don't sense the transcendental coming from, you know, a cardinal who's basically a CFO of an organization, basically on the board of directors of a major corporation, which is basically what a cardinal is. I think they are lacking the deep spiritual source that they need from organized religion. So they've probably become cynical, and they're looking for to other areas, to other ways of making that connection.
At that time when this was going on, was this a secret, or was this widely known what the nine attendees were up to?
No, that was quite secret at the time. This was not openly discussed at that time that it was happening. This was during the Korean War.
So this was their little bit.
This was their little bit, yeah. Puharich was involved in intelligence work, and he was involved out of Fort Detrick. We're not quite sure in what capacity. And this was, as I say, during the Korean War. So it was a very paranoid time in the United States. It's the Cold War. We're fighting the Chinese and the Russians and everything else. And I think that a lot of this was being kept under wraps. I think that Puharich saw military applications to this. He made speeches. He had seminars to the military regarding using the paranormal in a military context. So I think that he had his own agenda as well with the nine.
Well, this is 1952. Was he aware of what Hitler did with the occult?
I'm not sure that he was.
When did that finally come out?
That really didn't start to come out until much later. There was a lot of speculation about it. In 1960, a book called The Morning of the Magicians was published, first in France and then an English translation here. And that talked a lot about Hitler and the occult. And that was a runaway bestseller for years. But it was so poorly documented that no one knew what to make of it. I think the real documented books did not come out until relatively recently. And I'm arrogant enough to say that my book on Holy Alliance was probably one of the first that went to the primary sources and said, here are the German documents, here are the Nazis in their own words saying what they were up to. And I think around the 1990s is when it became really an accepted part of historical literature that Hitler was involved or the Nazis were involved with the occult.
Dabbling in the occult, is it almost a form of brainwashing?
It can be, certainly. I mean, it's a venue for brainwashing. And since we're talking about brainwashing, when the CIA became involved in mind control and brainwashing, I believe they stepped into an area we might call the occult rather inadvertently, in attempting to erase memory and in attempting to replace memories with fabricated memories and doing all of this. They were really walking in areas that had only been the province of the occultist.
They really tried to dabble with these things, didn't they?
Oh, yes. I've gone through maybe 10,000 pages of declassified documents by the CIA.
Which, I mean, we know they were trying remote viewing, but...
Sure. No, but erasing memory, creating assassins that way, even experimenting with the occult and with paranormal powers, these were all funded by the CIA in the 1950s at the same time that Puharich was doing his thing with the nine.
Maybe the Manchurian candidate was a real story.
Well, there's certainly evidence that it might have been, yes.
Stay with us, Peter. We'll be back in a moment. Then at the top of the hour, we'll open up the phone lines. We'll give you an opportunity to chat with our guest, Peter LaVenta, right here on Coast to Coast AM. We're going to talk about wandering bishops.
What?
Yep. Wandering bishops. Strange episodes in some of Peter's work. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Peter, tell us about the wandering bishops that you write about in your book.
Yeah, I think that Sinister Forces is probably the only place you're going to read about this. The wandering bishops are another one of these strange little subcultures that that I've investigated over the years. And they show up in everything from the Kennedy assassination to the Bobby Kennedy assassination to Iran-Contra. I mean, everywhere.
This is weird.
These are members of very small churches, churches that were created basically on paper. The members of the churches are all bishops. Sometimes they're priests. But there's very rarely any actual congregation. I mean, no one is actually attending services for the most part.
Catholics?
Well, they're called Old Roman Catholic, which is a kind of an offshoot or a sect of Roman Catholicism that the Catholics don't really recognize. And sometimes they're Orthodox, an offshoot of the Russian or Greek Orthodox churches, which, again, the Orthodox churches probably don't recognize. So you have these small little groups of people, and they're all bishops, and this is a very strange subculture, and you wouldn't even notice them except for the fact that, for instance, around the Kennedy assassination, as an example, in New Orleans, at the office of Guy Bannister, the FBI agent who had left the FBI and was running a detective agency in New Orleans, out of which Lee Harvey Oswald was running his Fair Play for Cuba committee, you had David Ferry. If you saw the movie JFK, you'll remember Joe Pesci as David Ferry with the red wig. We had David Ferry, Jack Martin, and a number of other people were all bishops in this church. And that's an aspect of their lives that is almost never covered in, by mainstream historians because they don't know what to do with the information, quite frankly. And these people, they're called wandering bishops because they don't really belong to any major organization. They don't have congregants. They don't have the faithful or non-attending services. So they really are sort of bishops without portfolio.
Who appoints them?
Well, they're appointed sometimes by each other or by other bishops, other wandering bishops. I mean, it's a, like I say, it's a very strange subculture. It's almost like a cult or a secret society.
All by itself.
All by itself, and it's sort of freestanding. And we find them involved in the Kennedy assassination conspiracies. We find them involved in Bobby Kennedy's assassination. And then we find them again in Iran-Contra. There was a priest called Christopher Dowling who gave evidence before the Iran-Contra committee. Everyone thought he was a Catholic priest, and it turns out he wasn't. He was a member of one of these strange little churches with links back to Ferry and Jack Martin.
Now, what about Bobby Kennedy? What's the tie-in with him then?
Well, one of the people who was allegedly the hypnotist who had hypnotized Sirhan Sirhan, possibly to commit the assassination, was himself a bishop in one of the wandering church
circles. Oh, this is too strange, Peter.
Yeah, it is. It's very unusual, very strange, but the documentation is solid. I mean, it's true. These people were bishops in these churches.
Can one assume that this organization may be behind all these murders and assassinations? Was it involved in the Martin Luther King assassination?
Well, it's certainly when I knew them, and I knew some of them back in the late 60s and 68 and 69.
You knew these people personally?
I knew some of them personally. Yes, I didn't know David Ferry, but I knew the church he belonged to and some of the other bishops that he belonged that were his colleagues, if you will. And I know that organization was a front for American intelligence. I mean, the man in charge of it blatantly told me.
Now, did they wear priestly outfits?
Absolutely. That was part of the charm. An intelligence agency can use people dressed as priests and bearing certificates of ordination or consecration as couriers or as people to perform intelligence functions.
They tend to get in places where most people would not.
Certainly. Absolutely. I mean, if you're dressed in a clerical collar, you can visit a hospital at any time of the day or night. You don't have to worry about visiting hours, for instance. They can travel virtually anywhere. And back in the 50s and 60s, they were practically invisible. No one really paid a second thought to someone dressed in a clerical collar. I mean, they were given carte blanche. They were allowed to do whatever it is they were doing. People tried to help them as much as possible with transportation, with anything. So it was an excellent cover for an intelligence operation.
And the big question is who was in charge of the operation? Was it a government or was it a group?
Well, it appears to have been a government agency. In the case of the church to which David Ferry belonged and Jack Martin and some of the others, there seems to have been a U.S. government agency presence behind it.
Absolutely stunning.
And again, you'll hear about that. You'll read more about that in very great detail in Sinister
Forces. So they all had the garb.
Yep.
They walked around. Was there a facility then that they'd pop in and pop out of that looked like a church?
Not that I know of, no.
Okay. They just walked around in the garb.
That's right.
They could have all been CIA agents. Who knows?
Exactly, yeah.
Nobody has ever mentioned this.
No, this is some of the information, as I say, you'd only find in my book.
I mean, this alone could solve most of these assassinations.
It could go away towards doing that, yes, I believe so. There's definitely some smoking guns.
Is it still going on, Peter?
Sure. As I said, as late as Iran-Contra, it was going on.
I mean, even now, do you think?
Sure. They still exist. The organization still exists. What they're up to, I really don't know.
How did you come across this?
I initially came across it because there was a church building in the Bronx where I grew up, and I managed to locate a church there, and I just innocently walked in on a Sunday morning, and there was nobody in the church, nobody in the pews. There were a couple of priests performing the services up front, and sort of perfunctorily, as if they had to do it. And I eventually made friends with the people there and started talking to them and gained their confidence. And they began talking to me about their organization. I was a young lad at the time; I was about 19 years old. And they probably were looking at me as another prospective recruit.
Right. Well, what if some parishioner wanted to go in for church services? What would they have done?
Well, they would have carried on as normal. They would have behaved as if they were a normal church. I mean, they did perform their services on Sunday. This was the only group that I know that really adhered to that. But again, this was the headquarters of this organization, so I guess they felt they had to.
I guess, could you say then that these people were part of an occult, or would you simply say they were undercover?
I'd say they were undercover, certainly, but some of the members who belonged to this organization were involved in the occult, David Ferry being a prime example of that. David Ferry was very interested in the occult, was involved in hypnosis, was involved in the paranormal, was involved in occult studies of various types and kinds. So people who've known him have written about him from that point of view. So he's just one example among many.
Isn't it interesting that we lose New Orleans, and of course I trust it'll get rebuilt, but it was, you know, the involvement of these people in the Kennedy assassination, at least their names popping in and, you know, popping out.
Sure.
Strange indeed. Sometimes you wonder if there was information there that they needed to get rid of.
Well, I wrote it on my website that that was one of the concerns that I had, that with the floods in New Orleans, that we would lose archive material or something, that we don't have any idea yet what might have been lost.
Let's go back a little bit to the Indiana Jones movies, because that movie and those series of movies were just fantastic. But the quest for the Ark of the Covenant, in this, did they ever find anything? Did the Nazi Party ever come across any of this incredible material, these artifacts?
I don't believe they came across anything resembling the Holy Grail, as an example. The officer who was sent to search for the Grail eventually either was murdered or committed suicide in around 1938, 1939. And he was sent looking all over Europe for the Holy Grail. And I'm not exactly sure why he was murdered or suicided.
And why did the Nazis want the Holy Grail?
As a power source, they didn't see the Holy Grail as a Christian symbol necessarily. They saw it as something ancient and pagan and powerful.
I see. Okay. And they figure if they possessed it, they'd have this omnipotent power with it.
Exactly.
And how many, what kind of resources did they devote to trying to find these things?
Well, the people who were sent out were all members of Himmler's personal staff. So he funded it. It was funded through the SS, and we really don't know how much money was spent.
I bet money was no object, though.
I believe it was not. No, not with the SS, it wasn't.
And these people went everywhere, throughout the Middle East, Egypt, you name it. That's where they
Tibet,
went.
There was an expedition to Tibet. The Nazis who went to Tibet later came back and were responsible for some of the most horrible medical experiments at the death camps. And these were anthropologists and botanists and people like that who went up to Tibet to investigate who knows what, and came back after the expedition and wound up in charge of medical experiments.
I always heard that they possessed the spear that was used to lance Jesus when he was on the cross.
I believe that that is true. I think that's one of the objects they did manage to obtain, because that was in a museum in Vienna. And when Hitler invaded Austria and took that over, I believe that he did acquire that lance. Whether that was the real lance that pierced the side of Christ or not, of course, that's another
question. Story.
But that lance was believed to be so, and Hitler did acquire that during the war.
And what has become of that? That's gone now.
No, I believe it was returned to the museum eventually.
Really? So it's still there?
I think it's still there.
Well, that's a pretty interesting relic all by itself.
Oh, yeah.
When you investigated the occult, was there anything that you came across that that bothered you? Not in terms of data, but in terms of the fact that it really was going on or happened.
Well, phenomena would take place that would concern me. I mean, when you start to investigate material like this, there's a phenomenon that people recognize that begins to happen, and that is coincidences begin to multiply. You suddenly find yourself having access to material that you shouldn't have had access to. Things begin to fall in your lap.
And you begin to wonder why, don't you?
Yeah, you wonder why. It just happens. Things, impossible, scenarios take place. And I'm not the only one who's noticed this. I think other writers who get involved in this suddenly find themselves with the information that they need just showing up. And it's very strange when that begins to happen. It's almost otherworldly, because these coincidences multiply like crazy. And in Sinister Forces, in my book, I talk about that. I talk about coincidence as evidence of the operation of these sinister forces, of these forces at work, whether they're at work in nature or whether it's some other kind of force, I don't know. But you see these coincidences begin to happen, synchronicities, and it's incredible. You find yourself being surrounded by this phenomenon. And it makes your life easier, in a sense. You get the information that you need, but you always have this strange feeling that there's something going on you don't quite understand.
Do you believe that good will always beat out evil, Peter, in the long run?
Well, I'm optimistic enough to believe that, and to insist on believing it, perhaps.
Interesting message I got. We have Fast Blast. Someone says, please elaborate again, like you did. The occult doesn't mean evil. It doesn't mean bad.
It just means hidden. It means something that's secret. Originally, I think the occult was really the manipulation of forces of nature that were not understood or recognized by science. So I think that's really where occultism comes from. It's manipulating hidden forces. It's a kind of science, in a sense. So I don't think it's inherently evil. I think there's elements of occultism in mainstream religion anyway. As you mentioned yourself, exorcism being one possible avenue. But even in the Catholic Church, I mean, transubstantiation, I mean, transmuting bread and wine into body and blood, and all of these things have an occult connotation. They belong to the ideas of transformation of materials, of identification with supernatural forces. I think that occultism is a close cousin of religious practice.
Listen to this great message. This is from John in San Diego. Then there's another one from Kyle in California. I'll put them together. But they call the spear that pierced Jesus the spear of the Lance of Longinus. Returned to Vienna, one writes, by General George Patton.
Right.
Who, it is said, removed the point from the shaft with the idea of breaking its magical power. And then I have read, he says, that Hitler spent an hour or more alone with a spear and just dabbled with it. Isn't that weird?
Yes, it is. And Patton, of course, himself was no slouch when it came to strange occult beliefs. I mean, he believed himself to be a reincarnation of an ancient
Roman leader.
Roman leader, yes, exactly. And Himmler believed that he was the reincarnation of an ancient Teutonic king. So it was very funny. We had reincarnated military leaders fighting each other during World War II.
Would you say that people who tend to be, you know, I don't want to use the word wealthier than other people, but I'm trying to distinguish the difference between these folks, that they tend to dabble more in the occult than so-called average people, normal people?
I don't even know
what normal is anymore.
Yeah, I'm having a hard time with that definition myself. Wealthy people tend to, yes, I think, as I said, because they've become cynical about organized religion. And I think you may find that people on the other end of the spectrum financially get involved in the occult because they find it as a means of empowering themselves to deal with the world. If they can't deal with it through normal areas, through normal channels, then occultism seems like a way to do that, to contact powerful forces and to become empowered in the world to obtain wealth or to obtain prestige of some kind. So I think you find it in both areas.
Did you ever stumble across people or some of these groups who dabbled in trying to do time travel, whether they were doing it through their conscious or subconscious mind, in things like that, that they try to, you know, prophesize the future in different areas?
Yes, I think that this is one of the main things that people get involved with occultism to do is to prophesy, and to do that by traveling in time somehow. I think it goes back to the quantum concept of non-locality, that, you know, events that seem to be far removed in space and time are not really at the level of quantum physics. And I think there's been an attempt, I mean, by Puharich, certainly, and the people around him and the people at Stanford Research Institute were looking to do the same things. I mean, remote viewing is a type of time travel, if you think about it. If they are traveling to distant places and coming back at the same moment, they've time traveled. You know, it's not just a space travel. So I think that these occult forces are something that everyone has been involved with one way or another.
You mentioned earlier that there's something called the Church of Satan, which you said is not directly Satanist. Tell me the difference here.
Well, the Church of Satan was started by Anton LaVey in the 1960s, and it was kind of a glamorous attempt to popularize a kind of Ayn Randish self-realization. I mean, it really wasn't Satanism the way we understand it. It was more showmanship.
Trying to make it chic, I guess.
Huh? Yeah, he attracted a lot of Hollywood celebrities to his operation as well. He was based in California, and he had a lot of Hollywood people that would join, Jane Mansfield probably being the most famous.
Well, and look what happened to her.
And look what happened to her, exactly. So, I mean, it was that kind of an operation. It was a lot of showmen. Anton LaVey was a showman. He liked dressing up in the black cape and the horned hat and all of that.
Okay.
And I think that's really what was his emphasis.
And he went around Hollywood that way?
Yes, he did. And he drove a hearse, you know, that sort of thing, painted his house black. And
Was he particularly evil?
I don't think so.
All right, you know, he's just playing the game.
Just outrageous.
He was Halloween 24/7.
Yeah.
All right, well, stick with us, Peter. We're going to take phone calls at the top of the hour with our listeners and our favorite guests. Peter Lavenda is our guest tonight. His website is sinisterforces.info, linked up at coasttocoastam.com. A couple of his books, The Unholy Alliance and Sinister Forces. We'll be back with Peter Lavenda and your phone calls on Coast to Coast AM.